You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
My name's Tom Carver. I'm Vice President for Communications and Strategy at Carnegie, and thank you very much for coming tonight. This is the first time we've ever done this, so if there are little bumps on the road, hiccups, you know, apologize in advance for them, and we would really welcome your feedback afterwards as to how useful it was, and I can tell you how to do that. But basically, this is an evening of two parts. So the first part, we thought it might be helpful for you to have a, funky, little nightclub atmosphere, a kind of question and answer with Jessica Matthews, our president, and then after her, for a few minutes with a couple of the scholars, you know, so that you can learn a little bit about what Carnegie is, what think tanks are, what people do at think tanks, and so forth. And there will be a chance for people to ask questions. The mics are up at the front, so we can do this. So we'll do this for 45 minutes, question and answer. And then the second half is really just a free-for-all mingle outside in the foyer there. We have tables for every single program so that if you're interested in the Middle East or if you're interested in nuclear policy or something, there'll be a chance to learn more about that. And we've got quite a few scholars here on hand to answer your questions. Okay, so let's start. So Jessica Matthews, thank you for coming. this is where you work, but thank you for coming downstairs. Jessica has been the president of Carnegie for nearly 20 years and was before that at Council for Foreign Relations and the Washington Post, the National Security Council, the World Resources Institute. So she's really had an incredible career, both in think tanks and governments and journalism. So maybe we just start there, Jessica. I mean, maybe these are people who, many of whom are embarking or will be embarking on their careers. Do you have any tips for them? What was it that led you to work in a think tank?
Well, I'd say my career is probably not a good model for anybody else's because it was awfully serendipitous. I finished a PhD in molecular biology and came to Washington in the first class of AAAS, American Association for the Advancement of Science, Congressional Science Fellows, which is a fellowship for postdocs to act as science advisors in Congress. And I ended up going to work for a fabulous congressman named Mo Udall, and he started a run for president the year I was with him, and that turned into 2 years and 3 years. And I ran issues operation in his presidential campaign. And by that time, I was lost to the lab, and never got back. Mostly what I tell people is, if you can possibly find the way to do it, is to do what you love best because you'll do it best. I mean, occasionally, I meet with people early in their careers, and they will sketch out for me a carefully planned succession of jobs, and including jobs that they don't particularly want to have, but that they think would be helpful for something else. And by and large, I think that's probably a mistake. As I said, it's better to do what you feel drawn to, what you feel passionate about, because you do it best. So. And one of the best pieces of advice that I ever got in the middle of the search process for this job, which took about, 9 months or something. There were about 100 candidates, so it stretched out over a long period of time. I got a job offer to go into the Clinton administration. And that particular job offer was for a job I didn't really want. It was a pretty senior job, and I was terribly torn because I had no idea whether I was going to get this job. And I went to see a very, very wise man who's no longer with us. And you know, I said, I didn't really want that job, because what I wanted to do was a line job rather than a policy advisor's job. I'd been a policy advisor too much. And he said, never take a job for another job. And by that time, I was so tired of trying to make up my mind that anybody who was so clear, I figured I would
follow it.
And as it turned out, the story ended well for me. But that's another way of saying what I've just suggested.
Let's talk a bit about think tanks. I mean, in your mind, people have different ideas of what think tanks are. What do you think a think tank is, and what it should do, and when is it most effective?
I think of think tanks as bridge institutions, and principally they bridge academia and government, or business and government, or science and government, depending on the subject. And it's a it's a fabulous niche, because it has the rewards of scholarship with the very special rewards of policy impact. And there's you don't get that combination in any other setting. In academia, almost with very, very few exceptions, you're too far away from policymakers, and you have a different audience. And a different set of criteria to measure, you know, how many footnotes rather than a policy idea. In government, you never have time to think. You respond and you deal with your inbox and you deal with whatever the day's crisis is. But ideas don't come from people who are in government. They often come from people who are out of government for a while, and one of the great geniuses of our system is that it allows people to go in and out of government. And very, very few other democracies allow that. In a parliamentary system, it's very, very rare. And it's, as I say, it's one of our great, great strengths. The same is true as between business and government or science and government. You're not doing the business of anybody except the public good as you see it. And I think you have more chance to have an impact on outcomes over time in this kind of a setting than in any other that I know. And that's what makes it so exciting and so rewarding.
And I want to give people a chance to ask you a question, but one last one, which is that Carnegie clearly is rather different in the sense that it has these centers around the world to a normal, well, to an American think tank. That's been in place now for about a decade. Is there anything you've learned from that in the way that the rest of the world engages with think tanks that you think is different to here?
Well, again, here, we have the strongest think tank community in the world, and one of the another of the great strengths of our system is that policymakers tend to listen. They read, some of them, and they pay attention to ideas, and they're open to ideas and new approaches with issues that they're struggling with. It's not true in lots of other cultures. And it's not true that the idea of a independent is such an overused word, but the notion of a truly, of an institution that is not serving anybody's either overt or covert agenda is not one that comes naturally in some other cultures. It's the notion that that an institution like ours might be producing material that is really of value to somebody in government is not one that comes in the Middle East, for example. By and large, people in government are a little bit puzzled by what on earth it is we do. They read op-ed pieces, but papers and reports, you have to get really clever at trying to get them, get the results into people's hands and heads. You have to be clever in a different way here, where you're swimming through masses of information and noise, and to get an idea into people's head it takes as much cleverness and entrepreneurial skill as the intellectual skill that went into developing it, I think. And that's really Tom's leadership job here. Other cases, you know, it's establishing the notion of independence that's really hard. We have an office in Beijing, and there people are extraordinarily transactional. They figure very much that if you do, if they support you politically or financially or in any other way, something, you might do something directly for them, and you have to explain that that's not how you work and stuff. So it takes creativity, it takes cultural sensitivity, it takes developing. Here's the most important thing it takes. What we've done that is unique is, rather than develop a collection of field offices, we took an American institution and we turned it into an international institution that's made up of a network of centers that are part of the countries or societies in which they sit. And they're locally led and locally staffed, and they work in the local languages. We run here websites in Arabic, Chinese, Russian, and English. Very hard to find any comparable institution in this country that makes a similar commitment to language. And our centers work in the local language. And eventually they become part of the society in which they are over time.
It's also worth saying that 74% of our traffic on our website comes from outside the U.S.
That's
three quarters.
That's amazing. So it's a very unusual, and of course the struggle, the tension is turning yourself international with three quarters of your audience outside the U.S. is staying relevant in Washington, because you got to do that at the same time. So that's tricky.
Okay. Well, we've got just a couple of minutes if anyone wants to ask a question of Jessica. It's a bit fight your way to the front. Yes, what you start.
There's
gentleman
two.
On the right.
Yeah.
So would you be able to describe the process of how Carnegie expanded overseas and, you know, what the decision was like doing that and what the actual
process was? It started in Moscow in the early 90s under my predecessor, Ambassador Morton Abramowitz. And as the Cold War ended, he felt that this kind of operation was one of the special strengths of American society, and it would be great if we could plant a model of it over there. Independent, peer-reviewed, serious research directed at the problems of government. And I was on the board here at the time, and I would say easily half the board was convinced it would fail, that there would be just no way to do it. And as it turned out, it was a huge success for a reason, principal reason that I think nobody anticipated. And that was that we were a kind of an island of neutrality in Moscow, where every other institution was in effect the property of its president, right? And either corporate or ideological. And we were the one place where people who violently disagreed with each other would meet, and or, you know, wherever invited to meet. And that was really new and fresh, and we were lucky because we arrived there just as the old Soviet institutions were imploding. And so there were a lot of very well-trained, first-class people on the market. And we were able to hire some fabulous people kind of right off the bat. And so Carnegie Moscow Center became very quickly a very well-known brand name in Moscow. And I once had a group of sort of young businessmen, 40s, sort of mini oligarchs, come see me, and they said, we want your advice. We want to start a Carnegie for businessmen. And I said, what? You know, I couldn't figure out what they were, but they, what they were talking about was this model of, you know, serious research, but directed at policy issues, real independence, and how could they do it? So it was a great success. There have been some pretty, you know, tough ups and downs. At the beginning, lots of people thought we were CIA front, and others pretended to think that. And you know, there, as I say, there have been bad times and good times, and times when the two governments were barely speaking, and we were the back channel for whatever constructive conversation was going on. Rose Gottemuller, who's now the Undersecretary of State for, what's her title? Non-proliferation and she was for a while the director of the office, and while she was there, she did the work that led to the New START Treaty with the guy who turned out to be her counterpart as the actual negotiator. So there's always been a tight back and forth between government and stuff. Anyway, over time we thought we had learned both sins of omission and sins of commission in how to do this, and that it was a model that we ought to try to plant elsewhere. So we got the idea of creating this global think tank. And then we sort of sequentially went, where are the other places whose evolution means the most to world peace and economic prosperity and social justice? So the Middle East, China, Europe, and now we hope in the next 2 months to 3 months to open our first office in South Asia in New Delhi.
Okay, one more question and then, yes.
As you said that Carnegie is independent from government, and besides doing good research, what else does Carnegie do to increase its influence on policy?
We do a lot of convening. There are times when being able to bring together people who ought to know each other but don't into the same room is a very powerful advancement of policy making. We used to have here a wonderful young scholar who worked on Yemen and the Horn of Africa, and he started a working group at one point on Yemen when it was sort of front and center. And I'll never forget, in that room, almost everybody around the table was from the U.S. government, and none of them had ever met each other. Not one, literally, I'm not exaggerating, had ever been at the same table. And they were all working on the same thing in different departments. So we do a lot of convening. We do a lot of briefing of people in important positions. 2 weeks ago in Brussels, we put together a long briefing for the new Secretary General of NATO. And we brought people from Moscow and people from Beirut, people from our Brussels office, some people from here, and gave him a really wonderful kind of sense. We do efforts to do things that we feel governments should do but haven't. George Perkovich, who you're about to meet, led a few years ago an effort to develop a code of conduct among nuclear reactor exporters, so that as a way to avoid a race to the bottom, as exporters competed for a finite market. So there's an obvious risk of looking for competing for that business, and then selling reactors to countries that really cannot manage that technology. And so we brought them all together. We provided all kinds of paid for and brought into the room expertise on the specific issues, and we drafted over 2 years, 3 years, a code of conduct that's now been signed by 10 of the 11 nuclear reactor exporters, and then helped them develop a way to do mutual enforcement. So all those kinds of work, you know, are to the same end, which is to have a clear impact on concrete outcomes.
Great. Okay, Jessica, thank you very much.
You're
we have to
welcome.
Keep going. Yes, one of them. So we're now going to move quickly on. Don't go anywhere. We've now got George Perfitch. Whilst they're getting ready, I'll just tell you who they are. So George here is Vice President of the Nuclear Policy Program here, one of the oldest programs, and in fact the largest program in terms of numbers of scholars involved. And then Karine Sajapour is the expert on Iran and works in the Middle East program. And I thought it would just be interesting to hear from them a little bit about what it's like day to day to work here at a think tank from two perspectives. So maybe, George, why don't you start? I mean, can you just give people a sense? I mean, Jessica's kind of outlined the broad parameters of what a think tank does. What do you do every day?
It's not a joke, but one of the remarkable things about working in a think tank is, A, it's almost impossible to explain to your parents and your friends and all of that. So when they say, what do they do, it's hard to explain. And then people generally say, oh, so you sit in your office and you, like, read and think great thoughts. And then we kind of often joke to each other, like, when the last time we read a book was. Because we tend to be actually very, very busy. And one of the hardest things is to find time to do the research and read. So a typical, and there's, because you and Jessica and I and others are in kind of the management too, I won't bore you all with that, but places like this, require a lot of effort to manage, and so there's a fair amount of time that's involved in that. But I think it, for you all, that's less interesting than the kind of the research and product development and so on. So I think one of the most important things that Jessica said was, and the best advice I could ever give is, figure out what you're really interested in and pursue that. And that will lead you in all sorts of interesting ways that you can't predict and that your parents wouldn't have predicted when they told you what they wanted you to do and all of that. And just do that and you'll be relatively happy. We have to do a similar thing because, okay, what should we work on? What are the most important things to work on first in our own view? Because it's hard to be a scholar or an artist or a chef if your heart's not really in it and you're not pursuing something that you find interesting. So there's a fair amount of time, either individually or as a group, saying, well, what is it that we need to be working on, that we want to be working on, and that we think are the most important things to be working on from the standpoint of, okay, big threat for the world or for a particular set of countries, a threat or a problem or an opportunity to which you can see a better outcome, because there are some problems or challenges out there that you just can't see a solution, so it doesn't do a whole lot of good to pursue that. What do we have the talent and in terms of our resources and expertise to be able to apply ourselves to try to develop what we think is a good outcome for this problem? And that kind of definition of the work and what we want to be working on is actually more difficult than it seems, and it's takes a fair amount of time. And then once you've done that, you have to figure out how to do it and how to get the support to do it. So think tanks vary in this town and in other countries in terms of the support they get from an endowment. So a rich person like Andrew Carnegie gave an endowment in 1910. We still have that, thankfully, but it, you know, provides less than half the support. So when you get an idea, you have to figure, okay, how can we make it happen? And so there's a fair amount of time that then goes into planning that, writing proposals, fundraising, and going out and getting the support to do the work. And then it's doing the work. And because we're very international, both in perspective and where we operate, almost everything that we do has a major component where you need to either fully understand, have partners, be working in another place that, you know, the nearest place is Europe. But a lot of work in East Asia, Russia, Central Asia, South Asia. So then you've got to have counterparts there. You've got to travel a lot to be doing interviews, to understand what's going on, to create networks and partnerships. So there's a lot of that we do. And then ultimately, in many cases, there's a written product. There may be other products, and Jessica alluded to the thing we did with the nuclear power vendors, which was done in private, not necessarily secret. We just didn't ever advertise that we were doing it. And it wasn't like there was going to be a written product necessarily. It was a negotiation. But a lot of what we do, there's an aim to have a written product. So you have to design that, and then you have to write that. What we do here, I think, that's different from a lot of places is, you know, send things out to other people in draft to get their responses, especially people that you think will disagree, or people from the other countries that you're writing about to get their perspectives. Are we getting it wrong? What are we missing? And so that kind of building in the quality of the work also takes a lot of time. And then there's the dissemination, and that can go on. Our colleague James Acton, who's here, did a fantastic report, you know, more than a year ago. It was finished on it's called Conventional Prompt Global Strike, but the development of new supersonic weapons that could potentially hit a target anywhere in the world in, you know, less than an hour. So he spent a lot of time researching that, writing that report, and then planned, you know, a promotional campaign, you know, for over a year of international travel, writing shorter pieces, going to international meetings. And so that's a big part of what we do is once we have something is you go out and promote it. Jessica made an allusion that people don't read in government for the most part. The busier they are, the truer that tends to be. So one of the things that you find out when you go in as a, you know, kind of young scholar, think tank person, and you meet somebody and say, did you read my report? If they're polite, they won't laugh. and if they know you well, they kind of go, of course I didn't read your report. What are you, crazy? I didn't read the paper. I did read my kid's report card. I'm not going to read your report.
So why do you write it then? I mean, sure that's what lots of people are asking.
It's a great question. Because it's a great question. For one thing, you have to get your own kind of thoughts in order and have enough evidence and basis to come to recommendations, and so kind of it's a way you show your work to yourself and others is by writing it and clarifying your own thoughts. But we have other audiences. We have academic audiences. Those people do read. So you'd have to have text. And if you didn't have a product, they wouldn't respect what you're doing because where's the beef? Where's the text? So you do it for that reason. And also, even though officials don't read, they appreciate that you wrote. And they may hand it to somebody and say, you read it, and so on. But what they will tell you is, you know, if you want to communicate your recommendation, you have to have an appointment. And so it's kind of old school. Given all the media we have and stuff, it's still face-to-face with policymakers is a way that you do that. But they'll say, so tell me in three sentences what I should know. And you've just written 300 pages. And so you have to write the 300 pages in order to figure out what the three sentences are.
Okay. Let's bring Karim in. So George has given a very eloquent description of the job. I want to just go a bit deeper. And, you know, what are the best bits and the worst bits of your job?
The best bits and worst bits. I'd say, first of all, thank you all for coming. And for those of you who wore neckties more than we did, I would say just to build on something George said, when people ask me, you know, what's the difference between think tanks and universities, one of the things I tell them is that, you know, we have to think outside the box, but we have to think within a box. And what I mean by that is that, you know, on one hand, you want to come up with original ideas. I work on the Middle East, on Iran, a region which is perennially in turmoil. And perennially, U.S. policy toward the Middle East is not going well. And so you're always having to think about, you know, new and different ways of doing things. But you have to think within a box, which is the domestic political realities, political constraints within the United States. I had a very famous undergraduate professor from the University of Michigan, and he still has a very famous blog. And, you know, the things he writes about the Middle East he's a very well-regarded historian and scholar. But he'll say, you know, we need to take a totally different approach towards the Middle East. For example, we need to replace our alliance with Israel with Iran instead. And you say, well, that sounds nice in theory, but you know, 500 members of Congress would disagree with that. So you have to think, you know, what is practical, what's doable, in terms of, you know, what's good, what are the pros and cons of think tank. I think what's unique about think tanks and particularly Carnegie is that every individual has a totally different experience. Let me start with the difficulty for myself personally, and I think this increasingly applies to other people within the Middle East program, and that is that you're working on a region which is becoming increasingly inaccessible. So, for example, I was based previously in Tehran. Before I joined Carnegie, I was working with the International Crisis Group. And, you know, that's what I love to do, to be in the field and do primary research, interviewing, you know, decision makers firsthand. And at some point, it became too dangerous for me to be based in Tehran. You know, I would be threatened. I would be called into the Ministry of Intelligence and interrogated. And then, you know, they made it pretty clear to me that if I stayed, I would go to prison. So I came back to the U.S., and subsequently they did, in fact, imprison numerous Iranian scholars, Iranian-American scholars, and think tank experts. And so it is difficult to work on a country or a region which you are not able to visit. And, you know, that's my case with Iran, but, you know, increasingly my colleagues who are working on places like Egypt, certainly Syria, that's the case, Iraq, Libya, you're either risking your security, you're risking your life, or you are potentially putting into danger the people whom you're meeting with. So I think this isn't a challenge which is unique to Carnegie. I always tell people, if you're doing your job right, you shouldn't be able to go to Iran these days, because, you know, if you're not... In some ways, you know, that's a con of it. The pro of that particular point is that, you know, once you know you can't go to a place, you don't have to pull punches in the same way that you used to do when you had to retain access. I think the wonderful thing about being in a think tank, and Jessica alluded to this, is that it's a bridge between, you know, so many different industries, whether that's government, academia, media, and every day is different. There will be days when you know, we're in the midst of nuclear negotiations, and I'll be doing a lot of media, National Public Radio, BBC. Sometimes I'll do the Colbert Report, Charlie Rose, and then sometimes the news is much lighter. There's other things going on in the world. And those are the great days when you can kind of immerse yourself into reading and research, interacting with members of Congress. So really every day is different. But I would say that, you know, there's two P's I think that are useful to take into account, and that is, you know, practicality. I always think whenever I write something, you know, does this pass the so what test? You know, why am I doing this? Is this useful? Can this be useful to the Secretary of State, or to the National Security Advisor, or someone at the White House? How is this useful? What value am I adding? I think that's always a thing I'm asking myself before I start doing something.
Okay, we've got to keep this moving along, so we want to try to wrap this up in a couple of minutes. Does anyone have a question for George and Karim? Silence. No, here we go.
You mentioned fundraising, and that's part of the job, right? That's true. Does Carnegie have certain criteria as to, for certain projects, you wouldn't accept funds from certain funders? Or how do you go about that? How do you suss out how funds your project will be perceived by the stakeholders you want to include?
That's a very complex question, but you're getting a very short answer.
I mean, it's the easy part is, you know, we wouldn't take money from anybody who would try to suggest what the conclusion or outcome should be. That's a no-brainer. When we did the thing with nuclear industry, we didn't seek or wouldn't take any money from nuclear industry just to make sure it was not self-interested, which, by the way, is kind of tricky because then you're going to other sources of funds who say, why doesn't the nuclear industry pay? Why are you asking me to pay? And you say, well, actually, because we want to, you know, avoid misperceptions. And they say, well, yeah, but this should be their problem. So it's that part's tricky. There are private foundations, and the best of which understand that they're funding kind of work on an objective, but don't try to direct it and respect bipartisan work and so on. So those are obvious sources. In some cases, I mean, basically what you do is we figure out what it is we want to work on, what the problem is, what we think the solution is, and then we say, okay, who do we think is interested in this topic and would like us to do the work on it? And then you go and approach them. And so I can hardly ever think of a moment where I felt like, ooh, there's somebody that I might want to go to support this thing I've defined, that if we got their money, I would be uncomfortable with it. I think the discomfort comes when somebody comes to you and says, here's something I'd like you to work on, in which case, in almost every case, we've said no. And so that I've been involved in. And so that one isn't actually as hard. The hard part's like finding people who want to support what you do. You know, saying no isn't so hard.
Okay, great. Thank you. So let's finish up this bit. We're now going to move out there where there are going to be food, most importantly, and tables, as I say, with different scholars and things on it. I just want to say that there are a number of scholars here. Fred Weary is here, Cornelius is here, James Acton is there, who've come, and I hope Karim and George will stick around for a bit. So feel free to ask them questions. And lastly, please fill out you're going to get a survey tomorrow, so please fill that out about whether this was useful or not. Thank you very much.